In 1973, a group of women from Mandal village in the Himalayas in India hugged trees to prevent them from being felled. When the loggers came, the women, led by Gaura Devi, surrounded the trees and shouted, "This forest is our mother's home. We will protect it with all our might." This was the beginning of what came to be known as the Chipko movement, which put a spotlight on ecofeminism. Consequently, when many people hear the term ecofeminism, it's the image of those women hugging the trees and fighting to save the forest that comes to mind. But what exactly is ecofeminism? And how and why is it such a powerful vision that may actually save our planet? Welcome. You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. Ecofeminism is a cross-cutting perspective that encompasses many issues, including food, climate, and energy. It offers an alternative to the oppressive patriarchal capitalist system that's had devastating impacts on the planet and on human lives and livelihoods. Ecofeminist analysis explores the connections between women and nature in culture, economy, religion, politics, literature, and iconography, and addresses the parallels between the oppression of nature and the oppression of women. It challenges the artificial division between the personal and the political, and the environmental or ecological, and seeks to show that social justice, interspecies ethics, and environmental concerns can't be approached as separate issues. Moreover, a growing number of ecofeminists approach gender as a social construct, challenging the men-women binary and rejecting the idea that women are somehow closer to nature, as this is part of the patriarchal frame that subjects both women and nature to exploitation. Our guest on today's podcast is a well-known ecofeminist who is well-placed to deepen our understanding of ecofeminism, especially as it relates to our food system and our relation with the land and the environment. Dr. Vandana Shiva is the founder of the Research Foundation for Science, Technology and Ecology. She is also the founder of Navdanya, a grassroots movement which promotes biodiversity conservation, biodiversity, organic farming, the rights of farmers, and the process of seed saving. Amongst the many books she's written, she co-wrote a book called Ecofeminism, written together with Maria Mies. She's here in conversation with Lavinia Steinfort, a political geographer and ecofeminist activist. Lavinia is a researcher at the Transnational Institute, where she's working on public alternatives such as remunicipalization of public services, a just transition towards energy democracy, and transforming finance for the 99%. Lavinia began with asking Dr. Shiva to unpack what ecofeminism means to her.
Yeah, hello, Dr. Vandana Shiva. So thank you so much for being with us. You're a world-renowned environmental thinker and activist, and you've really put ecofeminism on the map, teaching many of us that gender and environmental injustices are deeply linked, since exactly the same structures of domination are at war with nature, with women in their diversity, and with life in general. So based on that, I would like to ask you if you can explain all this a bit and further unpack ecofeminism for our listeners.
You know, for me, ecofeminism is not about abstract concepts. It's about the fact that around the world, women are the ones who are standing up to defend the earth. And for me, it began with women of my region defending the forest through the famous movement called Chipko. So I started to think a lot about why is it that the women come out front facing the worst violence, whether it's defense of land or rivers or forests, or in Bhopal against toxic dumping and toxic hazards. And my search then led me to understand that the same worldview which created colonialism, the idea that some people in other lands can be taken over, their labor can be taken over for slavery, that their lands can be taken over as property of the colonizer. That same process was also colonizing women and of course, colonizing the earth at large. We cannot forget that in 1484, there was a papal bull on witch hunting, and 9 million people were killed in Europe. Most of them were women. Most of them were learned women who had a certain kind of knowledge about healing, about medicine, and they were killed as witches. And then a little later, you get Mr. Francis Bacon, the Chancellor of England, and also the head Inquisition in charge, writing a book, The Masculine Birth of Time. He's called the founder of modern science. The Royal Society is named on him. And he defined nature as a slave to be subjugated. So here you are killing the women for their knowledge. You're declaring nature is dead. That urge is the urge of capitalist patriarchy, of colonialism. Ecofeminism is merely just the recognition that nature is alive and creative and the basis of life on earth. And women are the basis of the economy. Their work, their knowledge is what holds things together, not just in third world societies, but across the world. It's their work that has been defined into a non-economy, but that's the true economy. So ecofeminism is really removing the violence of colonization, the blindness of the earth as living, women as intelligent, the system that turned earth into dead earth and women into a passive second sex. And this was all part of one process. The same process then basically decided all of Africa could be colonized, all of Latin America could be colonized, all the world could be colonized. We are talking really about not just a part of society. We are talking about violence against all of the earth and violence to society through a very manufactured, illusionary idea that a few powerful men of Europe, basically white, were the rulers of the world. And they would use every means to kill the women, to kill the indigenous people, to kill the earth. And that process hasn't stopped. In fact, femicide is higher than ever before. Extinction is faster than ever before. Violence against people is so intense. Today, we are witnessing protests around the world. These are working people saying we are not being able to live. You've taken the ability for us to make a living beyond our hands. This, to me, is the ground through which ecofeminism puts the light on what is being hidden.
Mm. Wow, thanks so much for putting that very clearly for all of us that really need this kind of language to convey this important message. And it makes me think also of how ecofeminists around the world have really rightfully inviting us to learn from the wealth of knowledge that rural indigenous communities, among other racialized and frontline peoples, have been developing for centuries, as you say, indeed, centering values of relationship, of reciprocity, respect, relevance, and so on. So could you maybe tell us how we can best apply these learnings as activists, as scholars, or even as policymakers?
I'll begin with my own life. You know, I was studying physics. I was working at some point in India's nuclear establishment for training. I did a PhD in the foundations of quantum theory. And yet it was when I went to the villages in our mountain region in central India, where I come from, where the forests were disappearing and the women were rising. I realized that the women knew every plant in the forest. They knew every use of every plant in the forest. And I'd made them my professors for biodiversity and ecology. That was in the early 70s. That's 5 decades ago. Since then, we got the Convention on Biological Diversity because the same chemical industry that has poisoned the planet was wanting to own the seed. And that's when I started to save seed. But I learned about the seed from the seed and from women. Every year, I learned so much more because women have been left with nothing in terms of resources, but been left with the responsibility of taking care of children, family, community. And that has created the brilliance of maximizing efficiency. So as I've written in my book, Staying Alive is Something Anyone Who's Listening to This Podcast Should Read, I wrote it in the 80s. And my update of it in the 20th year edition, I've shown how on 2% land, women grow more food in Africa, in India, because the rest of the cultivation is basically wasteful commodity production in ecological terms, not producing anything because it's destroying the ecosystem, but in nutritional terms, producing nutritionally empty commodities. So if you start to look at what runs the world, what runs the world is the biodiversity of the world, which weaves the web of life. What runs the world is the knowledge of this biodiversity, which plant is good for healing, which plants are nutritious. Now with climate change, which are the seeds with the climate resilient? All of this knowledge is the knowledge that was treated as not knowledge, but it is still alive. Like the seed, it is still there waiting to germinate across society. And that is the work of Navdanya that started as a program of the Research Foundation for Science, Technology and Ecology. And I feel so happy to see we just give a call to women, just collect all the wild edibles that you eat. And they come out with 1,000 plants that none of the scientists know about. So it is a moment for the future of humanity to wake up to the hidden knowledge of women in marginal communities who have kept alive the biodiversity of knowledge and the biodiversity of life and the cultural biodiversity with it.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah. So as you say, indeed, like how these women in marginalized communities and including gender diverse people like have been developing, defending and practicing these alternative ways of cultivation and so on around the principle of care. Could you go a bit deeper into that? Like what these alternatives look like? You talk about seed saving and many related things like agroecology has been very often mentioned. Could you say a bit why they are the underpinning of an economy of abundance? Because we're constantly constrained by this mindset of scarcity and competition. And I really wonder how this can really be the future.
You know, I really feel that these great men, the father of modern economics, Adam Smith, the father of modern science, Francis Bacon, they have so polluted our minds with such an unreal idea of the world. For them, it worked well because they could take over the world. And when Adam Smith writes that we are born with scarcity, competition, selfishness from the wombs of our mother, he is violating both the mother and the child. Because we are born of love. We are born of relationship. We are born of oneness. We are not born of scarcity. The abundance that is created by the mother to feed her child. And in the worst of situations, the women will create conditions to nourish their children. So scarcity is a construct of greed. And it has led to a structure that has created such falsehoods. Falsehood number one, it gives primacy to trade. After all, what were colonizers doing? Colonizers were coming to our lands, stealing our spices and textiles and our gold and our silver. And they were treating that extractivism as the economy. But that's not the economy. Economy comes from oikos, our home. Care for the home, knowledge of the home, management of the home. That is economy. And that's what women do. Extraction from the house, extraction from the earth, extraction from communities is not economy. Money making, as Aristotle has said, is the art of money making. Crematistics is not economy. Women practice economy. The big rich men who are now the billionaires and the corporations are thieves, crematistics, stealing the wealth of nature, the wealth of women, the knowledge of women. I have fought so many cases against the biopiracy of our knowledge. So the first is pretending that trade is the creative act when production is the creative act. They render invisible the work of the peasant, the work of the worker. And that's where the entire accumulation comes from. But then they render invisible the creativity of nature, the creativity of women. Like I was saying, I have fought so many cases, legal cases, and we have won each of them, where the pesticide control from the plant called neem as a Directa Indica, was patented. And patent means the invention of the US government and W.R. Grace. And here my grandmother used to use neem to protect our silks and woolens from pests, to protect our grains. This is biopiracy, this false claim to creativity. This is the basis of intellectual property, which is bandied around in the world like the thieves of the world and are the pirates of the world. Today's pirates are the inventors and innovators. The third very, very big falsehood is the falsehood that you can constantly keep taking, which I call extraction, without giving back. Every system needs nourishing. If I don't give back to the soil, which is agroecology, regenerative farming, organic farming, give it whatever name you want to give it. But it is basically a giving back of organic matter to the soil so the soil can feed us. That is the circular economy, the law of return, of giving back. No society can flourish if there isn't a giving back to those who produce our food, our clothes, the things we use. And if there was a workers' movement earlier, and now there's a rising again of the dispossessed people, it is because there's no giving back. There's merely a taking. And there isn't just a taking. There's a taking and then multiplying it into fictions to create a fictitious wealth that is used to then control the real wealth of people. I'll just give you a simple example. How is Monsanto the biggest seed company in the world? Through patents and intellectual property rights. They never produced a single seed. They just took intellectual property on seeds. And then they could buy other companies and buy up policymakers. But the worst, and I do hope the community that is listening will realize, here's an economy that nourishes life and creates abundance. Take the case of a real seed. One tomato seed gives you 1,500 seeds. This is not a world of scarcity. It's a world of abundance if we allow nature to renew herself, to multiply, if we allow people to share in that abundance through sharing in the commons, and it's not privatized either through private property or intellectual property. They're now talking about nature's assets, taking biodiversity and putting it in the financial economy and allowing trade in these fictitious assets. And we saw what it did to the subprime crisis in 2008, brought the world's economy down. Now they're dreaming of 4,000 trillion, stealing nature from us and multiplying it in fictitious ways through the tricks of algorithms in the world's financial economy, which does no production, creates no wealth, creates no value. This is the ontological conflict that is brought forward. You know, we show how capitalist patriarchy is really a fairyland story. It's violent, it has real power on the basis of empty claims. But ecofeminism is about the true life of nature, of people, of women, and our power to be creative, our power to produce, and the value that we create and the rights that flow from those values.
Yeah. Yeah. It reminds me also of what you write in Oneness versus the 1%, how separation is violence and how all these patriarchal capitalism is really about separating us from nature, separating us from ourselves and each other. So how to transform, restore that relationship in a way. So what I was also wondering about, as we see many states, as well as big business, kind of continuing to bet on markets and profit making and reductive mechanics, as you sometimes call it. And as a result of that, authoritarianism is clearly on the rise around the world. So can we zoom in a bit on the strategies and forms of collective action that should be employed to really create these mass movements for climate justice and really to have that collective power that can force public authorities to create the conditions in which ecofeminist realities can thrive?
I think societies have always flourished when they have realized they are part of nature, that humans are part of nature, we are not separate from nature, we are not our masters and conquerors, and that all value created by human beings, women's work, peasant work, craftspeople's work, work in the service sector, all of this work is of value, not measured in terms of money, but measured in terms of maintaining what I call the infrastructure of life. At a time where literally owning this infrastructure is what the billionaires want, and they've created the asset management funds, the BlackRocks and the Vanguards, which we discovered in the search of, you know, in writing the book Oneness versus 1%, we realized the corporations weren't owned by simple citizens. The corporations were now owned by the billionaires through their asset management funds, like the BlackRocks, the Vanguards, the State Streets, and they are controlling 70 to 75% of all corporate shares. And they're deciding whether Bayer will buy Monsanto, whether GMOs will be pushed, whether lobbyists will try and destroy the European system of treating the gene-edited crops as GMOs. What is it that we can do? At every step of enclosures of our commons, we must organize to defend our commons. I did that in my life through the seed. When the Monsantos wanted to own every seed, and they had said by the year 2000, all seed will belong to the four corporations whom I call the poison cartel, we said we will save the seed because seed has its freedom to evolve. Farmers have the freedom to save and exchange seed, and people have the right and freedom to eat food from real seed rather than the toxic GMOs. Well, once we started to do that work, we actually saved seeds. Once we started to do that work, the political discourse changes. We started to write laws that recognize that seed is not an invention and farmers have rights. I think the big place where concrete action of organizing is vital in our times is food. Food is where greed is descending. Began with the seed and the Monsantos wanting to own and patent seed. But if you look at Mr. Gates, you know, he actually stole all the software programs, which he then patented. He didn't do any invention. Totally false story. But he now wants our food. And he wants our food through two means. Number one, remove farmers from farming. Farming without farmers is a slogan. And by removing farmers, have bigger machines, tractors without, you know, driverless tractors without farmers, spraying Roundup from the skies, more long distance transport, more robotic harvesting because it's too troublesome to have people to harvest food. All of this digitalization, robotics, artificial intelligence being pushed into agriculture by Mr. Gates through his Ag One, which I did talk about in the book Oneness versus 1%, that is a place where they want to create new extractive systems, but therefore create more destruction of ecological cycles that support nature, soil, biodiversity, more monocultures. Bayer has already said that we are ready with bigger farms, which will now produce raw material of carbohydrates and protein. They want the end of food and the end of work. But then he also is planning fake food, no? Food made in labs, so that these large acreages will provide the carbohydrates and proteins and the feedstock for cellular meat, cellular milk, fish without the ocean. And they are doing such intense false claims, like because cows have four stomachs, therefore there's methane in the sky, in the air. Now the methane comes because you're forcing cows the wrong feed, intensive corn and soya feed, and you're putting hundreds and thousands of cows and sheep and chicken into factories, which is where the stink starts. That stink is methane. Methane is not the result of the four stomachs of a cow. Methane is the result of factory farming. And that should never have happened. So instead of ending factory farming, they're really talking about ending food and ending farmers. And so many of the processes today are against farmers being made to destroy their livestock, destroy their sheep, destroy their cows for a system created by the corporations and the billionaires. So we have to defend our food. And how do we defend our food? Grow our food. We have to grow our food wherever we can. We've got to have gardens of nourishment everywhere. In the cities, parking lots should become food systems. We should create food sheds around our cities so that we have direct links to the farmers and the big giant supply chains can be made redundant. Most importantly of all, we must create food communities, and we have to remember that we are food. Food is not a luxury. Food is the necessity of life. It's the currency of life. So corporations are focusing on stealing your food and stealing your life. You should focus on regenerating your food and regenerating life. And through that, the commons of our food, our seed, our land, our soil, and the climate. Because as I've written in my book, Soil Not Oil, 50% of the greenhouse gases come from industrial agriculture and industrial food systems. Well, instead of dismantling that, there's an attack on farmers and all kinds of farming. And there's a new attempt to create fictitious calculus like net zero. Net zero is a ridiculous concept where the polluters will keep polluting and will take the land of indigenous people or the small farmers who haven't destroyed the carbon in their soil for their carbon offsets. And the way this economics is being worked, they call it the plumbing, the way this infrastructure of plumbing is being worked, it will end up being like the conditionalities of the World Bank and IMF in the decades of the 90s and the 2000s. Now it will be the billionaire conditionalities to not just keep polluting, but in the process, take your land as offsets. In England, they have a concept called biodiversity net gain. I looked at this FAT report. Biodiversity net gain is, you know, real estate builders can destroy biodiversity, then get a credit from the government to buy some land somewhere else as an offset for the biodiversity they destroyed. This is a new colonization, carbon colonization, biodiversity colonization. What we need is self-organized, localized economies that support communities, not just for their basic needs, because the three crises that have combined right now in the world are the ecological crisis, the planetary crisis of climate disasters, and species disappearing, the extinction crisis. But the second is the end of work, and COVID accelerated that much worse. And the third is people not being able to meet their needs of food, clothing, housing. The three have to join hands. Our work in building local economies, living economies, as I call it, has to be to regenerate the earth, and we can address the climate problem of millions and millions of regenerative farms come up around the world. We can create work through this regeneration. And most importantly, we can provide for people's needs. It's in our hands to do this. If workers organized a century ago or two centuries ago for wages, it is time for us to organize for life.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, it's very interesting how you also connect the whole realm of food as life and as a necessity also to all our basic needs, as our next episode actually will be on universal provisioning, public services, and how ecofeminism is core to that. So there are so many links here. And what I was also interested in is how you have been talking about seeding freedom and how the community economy and life you're talking about, how that can also be a new basis, how ecofeminism can be a new basis for freedom way beyond the current definitions of freedom that people are used to.
Yeah, the current definition of freedom is the definition of freedom that came from colonialism, which had to destroy community and create individuals. You know, there are no individuals in nature. There is no species that sustains itself alone. And there are no individuals in societies. We are community. We are social beings. You know, we are ecological beings. So the idea of an atomized world, that's what I call the mechanical paradigm, didn't just create division in nature and destroy the relationships in nature or our capacity to see those relationships, but it also destroyed the relationships in society. And everyone was made to think they're an individual unto themselves. And then these individuals were taken out of their productive capacity, and especially in the last 30 years of neoliberal globalization, they were all turned into consumers. And as Margaret Thatcher said, pushing neoliberalism hard, she said, there is no society, they're only individuals. But she was so wrong, because there is no individual, there are societies and communities. And the first step is to realize, just open your mind and say, who sustains you? Think of all, think of the trees and plants that sustain the breath that you have. You are not separate from those trees. Think of the people around you. Think of your parents when you were children who have sustained you. Think of your friends today. During COVID, wherever people were totally dependent, they were not able to meet their needs. So many people went into mental depression. Mm. People didn't have food. Community kitchens came up everywhere. The communities I work with and the women, they'd give calls and say, you know, we had no scarcity of food, because we grew our food and we shared it in abundance. We were not dependent on selling what we grew to a corporation. And from our research, 5% stays with the farmer, 95% goes to the middleman. not only did they not let anyone in their community go hungry, in the process of COVID, they remembered all the knowledge of their mothers and grandmothers, of all the plants of immunity. And they started to make these kadhas. And across India, there was such a regeneration of knowledge. So the commons of knowledge, the commons of biodiversity, the commons of land, you know, so many of the women I work with have no land, but they form communities and do community collective farming. We'll have to become innovative and beat the game of privatization through a new creative endeavor of reclaiming the commons, rebuilding communities, and producing abundance so that no one goes hungry, no one is without work, and no one is denied the right to health and the right to knowledge.
Yeah, there's so much truth there. So I don't know, I wish I could just listen to you for hours, to be very honest. but maybe just as a last question from our side, you have been writing about ecofeminism for over three decades, and by now it's appearing in more and more debates. So what has changed, according to you, to get to this point? And how can we assure that ecofeminism doesn't become another buzzword? How can we avoid co-optation and make sure that it really stays that radical expression of the kind of transformation the vast majority of us so desperately needs?
Yeah, what has changed from that time is, you know, when Maria Mies and I wrote Staying Alive, then Maria Mies and I wrote our book, Ecofeminism. And, you know, there was a young generation of women who took it up and they got positions in women's studies. And then the backlash came and every young woman who was teaching ecofeminism was removed from her professorship. It was like the witch hunts of today. And that was about 20 years ago. What has happened is, in spite of all of that, ecofeminism as a way of thinking about nature, that nature is alive and we must not harm her, we must co-create with her, that women are the foundation of the true economy that sustains human life, and their knowledge counts, their work counts. And third, that women and nature are basically also symbolizing the rights of the last species and the last human being and the last child. So I think what has changed is there was an attempt to make it look like it was about essentialism, that we were saying this is in our genes, where I've never believed in genetic reductionism. I've never believed in essentialism. The very idea of certain qualities being only for women or only for men was part of a construct of patriarchy. We know in the world, we are equal to other species. They are our relatives. And we, as men and women, are actually equal in our species being, in our biological being. We might have differences, but that doesn't change our ecological status. It doesn't change our political power. It doesn't change our ability to think of oneness as one humanity on one planet. And I feel very happy that just serving the little seed and protecting the few plants, a university has grown on our farm called the Earth University, because it's dedicated to the earth. And next year I will be offering a whole week of ecofeminism sharing. And ecofeminism will not be hijacked because it is a practice. And as practice, it is about not letting someone else own it. It is about being ecological. It is about being feminist. It is about standing for workers' rights. It is about standing for the farmers who are a threatened species. Please look at the level of destruction where they're wanting to kill a million sheep in Ireland. And right now have ordered such huge killings in Netherlands that the farmers are on the streets. We are at a moment where every effort at defending life and its diversity is a huge contribution to a future world that belongs to all.
Yeah, maybe just to end with giving you the space if you want to share anything that we might have missed in our questions, any other business that you feel is important to touch upon for our listeners.
Well, I would just conclude by saying, you know, capitalist patriarchy has created chains and prisons for humans and animals, and it has made it look like this is the way nature works. And this is not the way nature works. ecofeminism is really the removing of these blinkers, the removing of the chains. And it is not just about women. After all, if you're talking ecology, it cannot be only about women. It can't be only about one gender. It is about the liberation of every human being and every species on this planet to be able to thrive in abundance and create a future that is not a prison of the 10 billionaires who control half the wealth of the world and would like to control all of it. We need to tell them this world is not for sale. Mother Earth is not for sale.
You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. This was a conversation between TNI researcher Lavinia Steinfort and Dr. Vandana Shiva, a world-renowned ecofeminist. This is the first part of a series on energy, gender, and ecofeminism. Be sure to check out the next episode, which goes into detail on ecofeminist energy systems. TNI's material is all free, but we would greatly appreciate your help to keep doing the work we do. One of the ways you can help out is simply to rate our podcast on whatever platform you're listening to it from. And please write us a review, which will only help us to get better at what we do. If you'd like to find out more about how you can boost TNI's work, please click on the Support TNI tab on our website, tni.org. If you have specific questions, requests, or suggestions for the podcast, please send an email to podcast@tni.org. You can also find us on social media at Transnational Institute on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you for joining us today, and be sure to tune in next time.